Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome, everyone. So today is the last of the series of talks I've been giving, Introduction to Zen Teachings and Practice. I just want to mention there's an article out front that is an interview with myself and two other teachers, one Vipassana and one Tibetan Buddhist on emptiness. They were all gone, so I brought some more in. It's a good introductory article, so feel free to take one if you want. So we've been discussing the fundamental teachings, the teachings of emptiness, dependent co-arising, no self, Buddha nature, practice realization, bodhisattva path, which I'm going to review a little bit for those of you that haven't been here or that are new to the practice. I'll give you a little intro so you can have some background to what I'm saying. And today I'm going to focus on the spirit of practice, the feel and the foundation of it, and some aspects of practice. What I'd like for you today is to leave with the confidence that these teachings and the practices that express them are completely available to you. Jishin, confidence, is very important in our practice. And as I hope you'll hear, and then I want to emphasize, this is completely available to you in your life as it is right now. You don't need to become somebody else. You don't need to go anywhere else. It's totally available to you, and you're totally capable of it. Okay? Okay, so I hope you leave today with a strong sense of that. So the teachings of emptiness and dependent co-arising tell us that we and everything else are not separate. We're not isolated beings. That we exist in our individuality. It's absolutely true. We don't deny that individuality. But we're also empty of inherent existence, we say, which means empty of separateness, empty of isolation, empty of fixedness, empty of permanence. We are completely dependent for our being on everything else. And that's true for every other entity or aspect of our world. Completely interconnected. So interdependence means when this arises, that arises. When this ceases, that ceases. It means that we can never find an isolated, separate anything. No matter what you look at, if you look at it carefully enough, you will see everything else. So when you look at a glass of water, you see all of the elements that made that possible, the people that crafted the glass, the boat that carried it here, the water that comes from and recycles through everything in our system. So the teaching is that this is the way things are. This is our reality. No fixed permanence, everything interrelated, dynamic flow of arising and passing away. And the teaching is that when we see that and we respond to our world based on that truth, our suffering is alleviated. When we cling and fight reality, our suffering increases. So our effort is to see clearly and to live our lives based on this truth. Now, one of the interesting things that happens is when we see clearly, our heart opens. Compassion becomes a reality for us because we realize that we are intimately connected with everything else. So this is a quality of life that arises and is nourished in our practice lives. And it is the basis of what we call the Bodhisattva way, the way of awakening and compassion for ourselves and all beings. The Bodhisattva way, Bodhi means awakening, Sattva means being. The Bodhisattva way guides us and keeps us close to the truth of interdependence. And it keeps us in community with all beings. It is the way we realize our practice. So it is the path of awakening, of enlightenment. Enlightenment is not something we possess. It is not something we own. It is not something we have. It is the truth of our world when we wake up to it. So the way is realized in our practice, made real. The teachings and the liberation that come from them wake up with us in our ordinary lives. When we sit zazen, when we're kind to others, when we live out and inherit, in a sense, the truth of our true nature. So Dogen, the founder of Soto Zen, reminds us again and again about what he calls Shuso Ito, practice realization. Our realization comes forth in our practice. It is not the result of our practice. So we don't sit zazen in order to get something. We don't cook our meals in order just to eat. The act of cooking, the act of sitting, the act of being kind is realization, is enlightenment. So there's no other self besides the one you've got. There's no other life that you have to have, or create, or produce, or most likely we get very mechanistic about things. None of that needs to happen for realization and awakening to come alive. In fact, trying to have another self or another life is a major waste of time. It's a distraction. It's actually a way of not taking responsibility. Oh, I'll do it later. I'll wake up later. I'll be kind later. I'll sit zazen later. Sometime when I'm perfect. Well, good luck with that. Right? So this life has everything you need. The life you've got has everything you need. And Buddha nature, the nature of our life, the reality of our awakening, is not different from our ordinary life. We simply need to enact the teachings. So I think I have a quote I put on the flyer for this series by Dogen. Day and night, night and day, the way of the Dharma is everyday life. In each act, our hearts resonate with the call of the sutra. So the sutra is the sacred teachings. So day and night, night and day, the way of the Dharma is everyday life. In each act, our hearts resonate with the call of the sutra. So if you're living in a monastery, your daily life is putting on robes and going where the bell tells you to go. If you have two small toddlers at home, there's still a bell. It's just in the form of a child's call, right? If you're at work, it's answering your email. It's going to the meeting. Those are the bells of your life. So wherever it is, whatever you're doing, that path of awakening is completely available to you. It's also true that our ability to practice the way is helped enormously by taking a careful look at what orders our lives. There's a theologian, James Fowler, who I like, a Christian theologian who I like, and he was set to give a workshop on faith. And so he came up with all these great questions. And then he was driving to the workshop, proud of himself, thinking about how great these questions were, when he realized that he had never answered them himself. So he pulled off to the side of the road, and he pondered these questions, which I recommend to you. I've twisted them a little bit for Buddhist vision, added a little bit. What are you living and being lived for? What commands your best time and energy? What supports and expresses your effort to awake to your life and the lives of others? What do you rely on and trust? With whom do you share your most sacred hopes for your life and for the lives of others? What are those sacred hopes? And how do you make them real in your daily life? Questions such as this, if we take time to reflect on them, help us get real and look at what we're doing and how we're doing it in a way that nourishes and supports us. So, you know, I encourage you to think about such things, talk about them with trusted others, make an effort to orient your life around these deepest values. This is a life of practice. That's what a life of practice is. What do you do? In Zen practice, we shift our basic orientation from the life of based on delusion, separateness, fighting with reality, fighting with those around us, separateness and fixedness, to a life based on the understanding that we and all beings are in this together. That we are in no way separate from all of reality. When we make that shift, each time we make that shift, that is awakening. That is the life of the Buddha. And we have specific ways, particular ways in Zen practice, that we do this, that we express this orientation. Over and over and over and over again. There's a metaphor for this that Suzuki Roshi drew on. And he talks about walking through a field wet with dew. When do you get wet? So in our practice life, we saturate our life with these teachings, with this shift over and over again, every day, day by day, in every activity. Remembering, returning, moment by moment, hour by hour, day by day, week by week. Not to get somewhere that's free from the complexity of our lives, but as a way of orienting and living in the midst of this mess, this difficulty, this challenge, this beauty. This is how we express our full humanness with everyone. So in sitting, which is called shikantaza, just sitting, this shikantaza is the heartbeat of Soto Zen practice. We come together, we sit together as ordinary human beings. Shikan is just, means just. Taza means sitting. So, just sitting is to sit wholeheartedly. This just means just to do something simply and wholeheartedly and fully. Justice. So in just sitting, we make an effort to be alert, to sit and attend to each moment wholeheartedly, with a full mind and heart and body. We take a physical posture. If we're sitting in a chair, we put our feet on the floor or on a bench. We take care of the body that we have. I've never been able to sit full lotus. You know? That's not the point. We sit in the most stable posture we can find. Sitting on the floor, if you're able, on a cushion is great. If you can't, you sit in a chair. Or you're on a bench. So we attend to our legs, our head, our mouth, our hands, our feet, our breath. And we have a mental posture as well. When you sit down, don't just arrange your body, arrange your mind and your heart. So we have an attentive mind, returning again and again to awareness of just this moment, the light on the wall, your breath, your body. Thoughts come and go. What do? You can hang on to them like a balloon that carries you up and away. Or you can let go and come back. We have a heart posture. The posture of the heart is one of kindness, generosity, and stability. You know, in the Christian tradition, they take a vow of stability. Well, that's what we do when we sit down. Sit on the cushion and make a vow of stability. Not rigidity, but stability. I'm going to sit down and I'm going to stay here. I'm going to pay attention. I'm going to be kind. I'm going to be aware. And that is the life of a Buddha, right there. No place else. So we sit in the faith that we are Buddha. We don't need to go someplace else. Every moment of returning with kindness and generosity and stability is the activity of a Buddha. Is the activity of awakening. Not so that we can get someplace else. So we seek to express our dedication to the way or exploration of the way if it's new for you. That's fine. With kindness and vigor. Energy. You know? This is not a passive exercise. So we don't cling to ideas of success or rating. Oh, that was a good period of zazen, that was a bad period of zazen. Of course you're going to have those thoughts. Everybody has those thoughts. That's okay. It's just another thought. You know, wow, I was really calm that period. That was sweet. Good. Good on you, as they say. What happens now? What do you do now? What do you do when you get up and you go out and find out you've got a parking ticket on your car? It's unlikely to happen here, but in San Francisco, where we lived for many years, it's not uncommon. So these ideas that we have, they're fine. They're important. If you have an idea of how you're going to run a meeting, that's a good thing. You go in, you run the meeting, falls flat or it goes great. Okay, next. So this spirit of kindness and next and attention is very important in our zazen and in our life. When we get up and walk, we have another way that we hold our hands. We move our feet in connection with our breath, our posture. We walk together so that we don't run up on somebody's heels or lag back. Today is a half day sitting, and I encourage you all to stay for whatever amount you can. And you'll experience together this movement of kinhin, of walking meditation, where we move together as a group. So our zazen, our meditation practice, is just sitting, just this, in the faith that this sitting is expression of awakening. And our effort occurs long before we take our seat. How many of you have ever had the feeling of being tense and wanting to get through the stop sign on your way to Zazen so you're not late? Yeah? A few are willing to admit it, right?
Today.
Today. Great. Perfect.
Run the stop sign.
Yeah. So what's that about? I'm going to get out of my way because I got to get to Zazen. So our practice begins far earlier than when we sit on the cushion. How do we handle our shoes when we walk in? We just toss them there? Do we place them carefully on the rack? Not in some kind of precious little bag. Are we grateful to the shoes that carry us around all day long without complaint? Who you are and how you get here is just as important as what you do when you get here. And what you do after you leave is just as important as what you do while you're here. One of the hallmarks of Zen practice is this seamlessness, this lack of division between one aspect of life and another when it comes to practice. You don't divide up, oh, I'm practicing now and I'm not. Yes, you might be sitting Zazen now, but hopefully you're bringing these teachings alive in your life. And this occurs at work. Work is very important in Zen practice. Dogen Zenji said, the way-seeking mind of the Tenzo, the cook, is actualized by rolling up his or her sleeves. By rolling up your sleeves. That is the activity of the Buddha. Let's cook some rice. Let's chop some vegetables. In other words, we dive into work. We engage fully in all aspects of our work. We don't see one aspect as better than another. We bring dignity to each aspect, each moment. Answering email, cutting vegetables, building a fence, cleaning your desk. It doesn't matter what your work is. What it is doesn't matter. How you engage in it is, from a practice point of view, is what matters. How you meet with a client, with a parent, with a coworker, with your boss. Doing the things you dislike, doing the things that you like. All of these are infused with an attitude of care and possibility. Dogen says, handle even a single leaf of green in such a way that it manifests the body of the Buddha. This in turn allows the Buddha to manifest through the leaf. Handle even a single leaf of green in such a way that it manifests the body of the Buddha. This in turn allows the Buddha to manifest through the leaf. So what are our lives like when we bring that attitude to everything that we do? All the people, all the physical aspects, all the beings, all the relationships, all the aspects of our life. At home, when we're alone, when we're with others. This is quite ordinary, right? This attitude. Leaf of green. Yeah. Just a leaf of green, right? Some piece of lettuce. Just a pencil. Just a computer. Just a car. Handled in such a way that it manifests the Buddha, it is Buddha manifesting itself, awakening manifesting itself. So all of our relationships with physical objects, with people, with dogs, with fish, with whatever, are what we call a Buddha field, a way to realize the teachings of awakening. We are relational beings. All beings are relational beings. So we attend to our relational lives. We seek those that support us. We seek harmony with those that we find difficult. We care for those in need. We recognize that we are in need. We respect all beings and support a life in which this is expressed concretely. This is another way of saying we take refuge in the Sangha. So in Buddhism, we say we take refuge in the Buddha, take refuge in the Dharma, we take refuge in the Sangha. So we take refuge in Buddhist Sangha. We come here, we chat, we welcome one another. How are you doing? We form bonds of friendship that support us in and out of the Zendo. And in other groups, we think of our workplace as Sangha, our families, all being. So our relational lives are multiple and manifest and complicated, and we return to our relationality in all ways. One particular way that's part of Zen practice is a student-teacher relationship. So when you come here, we don't ask you to have any particular relationship with one or the other of us. You know? But we offer guidance, we offer support, teachings, and a vital connection to the teachings. So in one sense, in our relational lives, all beings are our teacher. Every moment is our teacher. So you can be taught by everything, and this is very important. Dogen's very clear about this. We can be taught every moment by every being and every aspect of our lives. But there's a specific way that in our Zen practice, that relationship with a teacher is opens up a possibility for concrete, specific guidance, for honest reflection, a way to ask questions, an avenue to deepen practice. The possibility for taking the Bodhisattva precepts publicly in a ceremony with a teacher. And if it's right, ordination as a priest. So all of these things are possibilities when you come and talk to us, when you meet with us. All of this is structured by the Bodhisattva path for reflecting on our lives and the lives of others. In the precept ceremony, we take these precepts publicly. We say, okay, I'm telling you, I'm going to do my best to live by these principles. A disciple of the Buddha does not lie. A disciple of the Buddha does not take what is not given. You know? So, if you see me doing those things, you have my total permission to say something to me. Right? And inwardly, as a practice, a disciple of the Buddha does not lie. What does that mean in my daily life? What is a lie? What is the truth? These ethical choices, the complexity of our lives, does not make it easy. There's no black and white to this. It's ongoing exploration that we take on and reflect on and do our best with and apologize for the breaches that we inevitably have. So it's not about perfection. It's not about protection. It's about support and engagement. The precepts are a challenge, a lens, an avenue to wake up to who we are and our relationship with others. They're a way of taking responsibility for our lives. So another thing that you'll notice about this place and Zen temples is forms and rituals. You know, we have these things we wear, these things we wear, and we have these little black cushions, and they go in a certain way, and there's an altar, and, you know, it's not just an empty room. You notice we bow to, in a way, our cushion. We sit facing a wall. We arrange ourselves in a certain way. After Zazen in the mornings, we have service. When I entered here, I offered incense to the Buddha and lavender buds, because we don't light incense in this room. We offered little crushed lavender buds to the Buddha. Chanting. We do these things daily. We also have Bodhisattva ceremonies where we chant and bow and take refuge together. on the full moon, we have ways of eating called orioki. We have bowls, and there's certain ways you handle them. It can all be very anxiety-producing if you think that the point is to get it right. You know, it's like, oh my goodness, there's these bowls, or am I holding my hands right? Or we were at a teacher's meeting at a with a Japanese soto shu, and one of our friends who's a Japanese priest said, in Zen monastic life, we take funny things really seriously. I thought that was great. These ways of being are more than mindfulness techniques. They communicate something to us directly. They communicate the teachings directly to our bodies and hearts and minds. When we bow, we know something. Our body knows something that we may or may not be able to cognize. When you bow and you put your head on the floor and bring your hands above your head, or when you put your hands in gassho and bow to your cushion, you're expressing something with your body. And then you can come up with ideas about what it is or it isn't. But the expression and the activity manifests something real. And we do this together. We chant together, we bow together, we express our gratitude together. You can do this. You do this formally in this space, but you can do it in your own home. We are touched and transformed by these things. They draw us in. They give us strength. When you express gratitude for the food that you receive and all the beings that brought it to you, that's a certain orientation towards your food, right? Something's expressed in that. And by the way, these things don't have to be public. One of our friends who's a Tibetan Buddhist teacher taught us this secret ritual for giving thanks when you go out to dinner in a restaurant. You take your plate, say, this is your plate. Put your finger underneath it and say, Bon Appetit, Three Treasures. Nobody even needs to know you're doing it. There's something about that. Or you can share that with your friends and have fun with it. We have rites of passage, like I said, where you take the precepts. And when you do that, you sew raksu, one of these. And each stitch, namuke butsu, I dive into, I return to, I take refuge in the Buddha. Every little stitch. You can see some of the people that have rakusus on, you can see their stitches. And it's also quite, revealing. Because they're your stitches. And you might be very precise and have these lovely tiny little stitches. And it might be kind of a train wreck. But they're your stitches. We also study together. We have classes and study groups. You can take up a book and spend a lifetime with it, like Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. Take little nourishing bits of it to help you fuel your day. We can come together and we can explore the teachings together. You can come to Dharma talks. However, you feed yourself the Dharma through study. And it doesn't have to be. One of my first teachers was Isan Dorsey at Hartford Street Center. He was my first teacher. And he proudly said that he read one book his entire life. And he manifests the teachings beautifully. And some of us are more geeky than others. We like to really know and learn and study all the sutras and what happens, how one's related to the other. That's great, but what I'm talking about in terms of study is not about accumulating a whole lot of knowledge. It's about a relationship to the teachings. It's about engaging with the teachings and allowing them to touch and transform your life. So a life of practice is like a pilgrimage. There's this movie that Shinshu and I saw about the Camino de Santiago de Compostela. There's two movies out, actually. The one I'm talking about was a documentary. And it's a wonderful movie, so if you have a chance to see it. Or if you want to go do the pilgrimage yourself, that's cool too. This is a pilgrimage that occurs across the top of Spain. And so in this movie, all these people started out with these ideas about what was going to happen to them on the pilgrimage. You know, they were going to do this, or they were going to do that, or they were going to have this reason or that reason for going. One woman was like, really like, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to have this, you know. And she's pushing a baby stroller, of all things. So those ideas faded pretty fast. Inevitably, what they thought was going to happen didn't happen, and things that they didn't expect did happen. Hardy young men that got blisters and had to borrow shoes and take breaks. You know, people who found a strength they didn't know they had. Their reality, the way they understood their lives, was transformed just by walking. They were touched, moved, transformed. They were in partnership with other people and to form groups, cook for one another. So they had a goal. But the actual expression of the practice was one foot in front of the other every day. And some of them walked longer than others. Some of them did the whole pilgrimage. Some could only manage to do part. For many, it was harder than they thought. And the reasons that they had faded as they walked, but they kept walking. There's a kind of faith here. It's in the walking that faith was made real to them. They grew and their vision changed. And for most, they didn't come out with tidy conclusions at the end, like, oh, well, check that box, I did that. More, it opened them to the possibility of their own lives as a path of awakening. And that journey, you could see, was going to keep unfolding for them long beyond the end of the pilgrimage. So this is the activity of practice, this one foot in front of the other, this pilgrimage of a lifetime. Responding to things that arise on the path, things that are unexpected, things we cannot change. We learn we can't do it alone. Caroline gave a great Dharma talk, I don't know, last year after hiking the Sierras. Trail angels, right? Mm-hmm. Make it possible. We all need trail angels. And we know that we can trust the path that was carved out by those who came before us. So we have a path to follow. We have things that we do together. We sit zazen. We pay attention at work. We learn the Bodhisattva vows. We study together. We sit together. When we're out at a restaurant, it occurs to us to say, Bon Appetit, Three Treasures. All of these things are totally trustworthy guides for how to live a life of awakening. And we are transformed as we do it, often in ways that we couldn't have predicted. So I want you to take away from this today, from this series, from whatever you encounter in your life, a sense of your own pilgrimage, a sense of confidence that you can trust yourselves and you can trust the teachings, you can trust the path and you can trust the practice, that you have good companions, and that you're fully capable of awakening. Fully capable of awakening over and over and over again in each moment.